Good afternoon, or morning, or evening, or whenever you happen to be listening to this. Welcome to Chapter 4. We're going to get started on mutual funds, investments for the masses. You ready? Slide number 2. What is a mutual fund? Well, a mutual fund is an investment company that invests its shareholders' money in a diversified portfolio of securities. Investment company is the legal term, but you won't hear people say that. You'll hear people say mutual fund. Mutual fund is the popular term. Investment company is a term that is applied to several different types of regulated investment entities. Mutual funds are just one of them, but by far they are the largest group. There are a couple others that are really small and are not that important. And why? Why would you invest in a mutual fund? Well, you get two wonderful things: professional money management and diversification. Now, are these guarantees? No, but there are two things that are difficult for the average person on the street to obtain. Each fund has a specific objective, investment style, and investment target, if you will. And there are over 10,000 funds to choose. Wait a minute, how could there be 10,000 different funds? Do you have 10,000 different choices on the breakfast cereal aisle? Well, it seems like it, but no. 10,000 different types of cars? It might seem like it, but no. Why are there 10,000 different types of mutual funds? We'll discuss that later when we take a look at what has happened to the industry in its attempt to diversify and market itself. Many people choose mutual funds for their retirement account investments, 401ks, 403bs, the traditional IRA, the Roth IRA, and for this reason, you really need to at least stick through Chapter 4 before you drop the class, because as a member of the great American economic machine, when you go out there and start trading your life for your paycheck, chances are you're going to have a 401k or some other type of defined contribution retirement plan to choose from. And 99.99% of them are going to have mutual funds as their primary investment alternatives. Okay, so let's continue. Slide number 3. Here's my... Oh, I am so proud of this graph. I did it myself. See how autistic I am? Artistic. Here we are. We're the little people. And more of them are women. Why? Because women are realizing that they better get their act together and not rely on the man anymore. And we give our money to the people in the top hats, and luckily more and more of them are women because it's already been shown statistically that women make better investors over the long term. Why is that? Well, think about some of the reasons. I'll tell you mine later on when we discuss investing psychology. And those professional money managers take the billions of dollars that are given to them by millions of investors and create a pool of, I know it doesn't look like a pool or a pond. That's what it was supposed to look like. Looks more like a potato, but bear with me, okay? And they create a mutual fund, investment company. And if they buy the stocks, it's called a stock mutual fund. If they buy the bonds, it's called a bond mutual fund. And if they buy the money market instruments, the short-term vehicles, the cash alternatives, then it's called a money market mutual fund. But usually the mutual fund disappears and people just call it a money market. And we see just the hint, just the beginnings of what has happened to the industry when we take a look at what's called a balanced fund. A balanced fund buys stocks and bonds. That's just the beginning to all the diversification and differentiation and marketing that has happened inside the mutual fund industry. Just the beginning. Slide number 4. Let's take a look at the growth of the mutual fund industry. In 1940, when the Investment Company Act of 1940 was put into place, was signed by the president then, there were only 70 mutual funds. 30 years later, the industry had grown to 350. Between 1970 and 1980, it almost doubled again to 600, almost doubled to 600. And then look at the growth between 1980 and 1990. From 600 to 2,000, and then in the 1990s were roaring years for the investment community. From 2,000 to 9,000, and since the year 2000 up until the end of 2010, we've added another 1,000, a little over 1,000. And I apologize, the 2011 data is not out yet. I like this wonderful website, the Investment Company Institute. That's the mutual fund industry's trade organization. It's a nonprofit, but it's funded by the mutual fund companies. ICA.org, a treasure trove of data. Unbelievable amounts of data there. Hard to get your handle on it all. Slide number 5. In 1980, 5 million Americans owned funds holding 3% of their household financial assets. As of December 2010, 91 million Americans and 52 million households own mutual funds. That's, you know, almost half, 44% of all U.S. households. And the assets at the end of 2010 totaled over $13 trillion. That's 23% of their household financial assets. Mutual funds are now the nation's largest financial intermediary, meaning somebody's holding somebody else's money, followed by the commercial banks, and the third, life insurance companies. Life insurance companies are often called the invisible bankers. Now, let's take a look at the bottom where it has this little disclaimer, not disclaimer, but footnoted information. This includes open-end mutual funds, closed-end mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, and we'll discuss these three types in detail soon, and what are called unit investment trusts, which are very, very small, and a type of investment company. So, at the end of 2010, there were $13.1 trillion in these things. At the end of 2009, $12.16 trillion. And at the end of 2008, it was $10.35 trillion. And at the end of 2007, it was 13. Yeah, 2008 was a very, very rough year, folks. Slide number 6. What are some of the advantages of mutual funds? Well, as we said, you get instant diversification, which is difficult for individual investors starting out to attain on their own. This process, it's a process whereby investors buy into a diversified portfolio of securities, stocks, bonds, whatever, for the collective benefit of the individual investors. This variety provides some safety, some, not all, that is difficult for an individual investor to obtain on their own. And we get professional money management. The mutual fund managers are supposed to know what they are doing. They are certainly getting paid well enough, folks. And sometimes a student will say, well, how do I become a mutual fund manager? I say, okay. First, are you going to graduate from a college such as Harvard or Yale or Stanford? And are you ready to take the Chartered Financial Analyst exam, which is three parts, and you have to take each part 1 year? You have to take the first one, and then wait a year, and then take the second one, and then wait a year, take the third one, and most people fail them. It's a very, very difficult to become a mutual fund manager. Another good advantage of mutual funds is that you don't need a whole lot of money. the initial outlay of capital with most mutual funds is $50 a month. Some as little as $25. Some charge more to get started, but normally you don't want to be involved with those companies because they're more specialized. $50 a month is most, especially if you set it up automatic payment from your checking account or your paycheck into a retirement account. Oh, they're very happy because then they don't have to deal with checks. They don't like dealing with checks. And lastly, this is not in your book, by the way. This is from the Wealthy Barber. It's the barber. It's the PETA factor. What does PETA stand for? Pain in the... Yeah, right. Folks, I have a renewed appreciation for how easy it is to invest in mutual funds. It doesn't mean it's not gut-wrenching sometimes, but after many years of eschewing, you like that word, eschew, you know, real estate investment as a landlord, as a real estate investor, as opposed to just owning our own house, my wife and I, we took the plunge and bought a duplex. And I'll tell you what a pain in the it was, and so far so good. You know, after the initial few months of pain and anguish and gnashing and weeping of teeth, I'm sorry, weeping and gnashing of teeth and beating of breast, it was a real pain in the neck. And so now it's a lot better. But I really have a renewed appreciation for how easy it is to invest in mutual funds. Somebody else deals with all the problems. Slide number 7. What are the drawbacks? Well, are mutual funds nonprofit organizations? No. They are charging you a fee. In fact, they're charging you a lot of fees, and that's our theme of the next presentation. How much am I being charged? The transaction costs. Some mutual funds charge order fees, which are called loads, sales charges, front-end loads, back-end loads. Many others are no-load funds, but they doesn't mean that they're cheaper. Some no-load funds can wind up costing you more than load funds over time. Why? Because there are always annual management fees, annual operating expenses, which can be quite low or can be quite high. And many mutual funds do not match the market's performance. Wait a minute. You have a mutual fund to invest in the stock market, and yet many of them don't even match the market's performance? Aren't the mutual fund managers supposed to know what they are doing? We'll discuss this and some of the reasons why it's difficult for many mutual funds to do as well as the market does. We have an entire chapter called Can You Beat the Market? And it turns out it's not as easy as it might sound. Slide number 8. Open-end versus closed-end mutual funds. Now, most of the time, folks, most investors never even know that there is such a thing as an open-end versus a closed-end mutual fund. They never have to worry about this. You are in an introduction to investments class. You need to know that what they are, and you need to know the differences. Not that it's likely that you ever will ever invest in a closed-end mutual fund, but still, you need to understand the difference. So, listen up. Slide number 8. Open-end mutual funds, the vast majority of mutual funds, are a type of investment company in which investors buy shares from and sell them back to the mutual fund itself. There's no limit on the number of shares that can be issued. Shares are issued and redeemed. You could think of the words create and destroy. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of investors. Investors can buy shares from, purchase, and sell shares to redeem the investment company at any time. That's why it's called an open-end mutual fund. When people refer to a mutual fund, they are almost exclusively referring to an open-end mutual fund. So unless they say, oh, I bought this closed-end mutual fund, when they say, oh, I bought a mutual fund, they normally mean open-end mutual fund. As of December 2010, there were 8,500 of these things, with $11.8 trillion. I remember, there was $13 trillion in mutual funds and 11.8. So the vast majority are open-end mutual funds. The other type of mutual fund traditionally was the closed-end mutual fund. These represent less than 10% of them. They're a type of investment company that operates with a fixed number of shares outstanding. Shares are issued by the investment company, by the mutual fund, only when the fund is organized. After all original shares are sold, you can only purchase shares from another investor. So they work kind of like stocks do. They're bought and sold like stocks on the open market, which means you can buy them and sell them throughout the day. As we'll see, open-end mutual funds only can be bought and sold once during the day, at the end of the day, the net asset value. Closed-end mutual funds are not as popular with individual investors as open-end mutual funds. At the end of 2010, there were only 624 closed-end mutual funds holding $241 billion. So you see they're dwarfed. They are dwarfed by the open-end mutual funds. Slide number 10, net asset value. This is the underlying value of one share in a particular mutual fund. And the formula, you don't have to worry about it. I'm not going to ask you to do any calculations. It's all done for us. At the end of every day, every open-end mutual fund is required to do this, according to the Investment Company Act of 1940. They are required to add up the value of the securities in the mutual fund, the stocks or the bonds or whatever, the short-term instruments, subtract any liabilities, meaning any payments they have to make, and that's normally very small. Somebody's redeemed some shares or they have to make a purchase of some, they've already purchased the stock, but they haven't paid for it yet. They have 3 days to do that. And divide by the number of shares. So you take up the value, you take the value of the securities, subtract any liabilities, very small, and divide by a number of shares. Open-end mutual funds are sold at net asset value, with a sales charge if it's a load fund. Since closed-end mutual funds are bought and sold on the open market, their price usually either reflects a premium or a discount to the net asset value because there is supply and demand within the marketplace. So these things are being sold like stocks. Somebody might say, I'll bid higher than the net asset value, or somebody might say, I'll bid lower. What usually happens is they're sold at a discount. Usually they are sold at less than the net asset value. They are very rarely priced at the net asset value. Now, the difference is not that big, folks. It's usually within, you know, 25 cents, but still, it's not necessarily the net asset value. And on slide number 11, we see an example formula. We take the value of the fund's portfolio, in this case, $10,050,000, and subtract any liabilities, $50,000, and in this case they have to pay somebody off who redeemed their shares, and they divide by the number of shares, 1 million shares. So that's $10 of net asset value. If there's a sales charge, for example 5%, the offering price will be the $10 plus the 5% and 50 cents. So the offering price would be $10.50. Very straightforward. Slide number 12. So let's take a look at the advantages and disadvantages, the pros and cons of each. From the open-end investment company, you're always able to purchase, buy, you're always able to sell, redeem shares. There's no market forces. You go straight to the mutual fund company and you say, I want to buy some more shares or I want to sell my shares. Open-end funds are very popular, wide range of choices. Now, this is not the investor's problem. This is a problem for the mutual fund company. Large purchases or large redemptions can make management of the fund more difficult. For example, if you have a fund that is doing really, really well, what's going to happen? You better believe you that people are going to take notice, and they're going to start sending you tremendous sums of money. Well, what are you going to do with it? I mean, it's a champagne problem, but it's a real problem because now you have to go out and put that money to work. The same thing is true when people start taking money out. You might have to sell shares at just the wrong time when the market's fallen. So this is a problem with open-end mutual funds. It's not the investor's problem, it's the mutual fund company's problem. And for this reason, sometimes when a company gets very, very popular and large, the mutual fund company will close the fund to new investors, which means, sorry, you know, we already have enough, we already have too much money, we don't need any more. If you're with us, if you're already with us, you get to put more money in, but if not, sorry. The closed-end mutual fund, the closed-end investment companies, work like a stock. You got to pay the broker's commission. You must buy them and sell them on the open market, and they're often sold at a premium or a discount to the net asset value, often a discount. But from the investment company's standpoint, from the mutual fund company, these are easier to run. Why? Because you don't have to worry about large purchases or large redemptions. You know how much money you have to manage, and you know you're going to be able to keep that amount of money to manage it. And what happens in the marketplace is the investor's problem, not yours. So which would you or which do you prefer? I don't know, but you're still learning about them. But you're going to find that the closed-end funds are just a very small portion of the universe, and it's unlikely that you will get involved. You may, but you probably won't. Slide number 13. There is a new type of mutual fund that's been around almost 20 years now, exchange-traded funds. Now, these are a bit of a mixture of the both. Open-end and closed-end. They are open-end funds, technically, but they trade on the exchange like closed-end mutual funds. So, like an open-end fund, there's no limit to the number of shares, but unlike an open-end fund, you can buy and sell them throughout the day, whereas all other open-end funds, you can only buy them and sell them once at the end of the trading day. There's no limit. The mutual fund company issues shares as needed, but the investor must purchase the fund using a brokerage account, which means you, just like a closed-end fund, incur brokerage transaction fees. ETFs, a recent entrance to the marketplace, are becoming increasingly popular. At the end of 2010, there were 950 ETFs totaling $992 billion. So you see, they've far surpassed the closed-end mutual funds. And you'll notice, end of 2009, there were $770 billion. End of 2008, $543 billion. At end of 2007, there were totaling $608 billion. At end of 2006, you see, the last few years, they've really exploded. But again, take note of the steep drop in value in 2008. Now, as of, I think, I should have written it down, but I didn't. But as of, I think, the end of October, the number of ETFs has not grown that much. I was really surprised. I thought it would be well over 1,000, but I think it was only, I remember 980 or something like that. And the amount of money that it has increased has really not been as much. So in 2011, for whatever reason, maybe it's because the market's become saturated, I don't know, but the growth of ETFs seems to have slowed considerably in 2011. And when we get the data comes out, I think, you know, beginning of March or so, we'll take a good look at that. But it looks like ETFs have slowed, their growth has slowed. That doesn't mean they're not popular. Still, you know, $1 trillion is still a lot of money, folks. Slide number 14. How are mutual funds regulated? Well, they all base their foundation on the Investment Company Act of 1940. It doesn't mean there weren't mutual funds before that. There were, but there was a hodgepodge of regulations that were overseeing these things. And there were some people who were saying, wait a minute, I don't like this. So the Congress got together and passed the Investment Company Act of 1940. It defined what is called a regulated investment company, also known as a pass-through investment vehicle. See, a mutual fund is a corporation, folks. And usually when a corporation makes money, what does the IRS say? Yeah, give us some of that in forms of taxes. But the mutual fund says, you don't understand. Wait a minute, you don't understand. We are investing on behalf of somebody else. So we don't want to pay taxes on the investment income. We're going to pass through the returns to our shareholders. So the shareholders pay the taxes. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Yeah, right. It does. To qualify as an investment company must hold almost all of its assets as investments in stocks, bonds, and other traditional securities, have very limited ability to use derivatives and other risky strategies. That's normally true, although there are some ways that some mutual funds and especially ETFs have slipped through the cracks, and you might have heard of hedge funds, which really aren't mutual funds, and we'll discuss them later on. So in general, most all investment companies must do what they say they're going to do, invest in stocks or bonds or other traditional securities. And they must use no more than 5% of their assets when acquiring a particular security. Huh? What does that mean? Well, think about it. If you can invest no more than 5% of what you have into any one individual investment, and you have 100%, right, you have all the money you have, that means 100% divided by 5 is 20. You must have at least 20 different stocks or 20 different bonds. Now, in practice, they usually have more than 100 or 200, but you understand the idea? The Investment Company Act is enforcing diversification. You can't just put all your money in one company. If you're a hedge fund, you can, but mutual funds, no, they can't. And they must create an organization with checks and balances. Have you heard this term before? Yeah, we used to describe it to our government. Not so much anymore. Slide number 15, I guess. It doesn't have the slide number anymore. But this is from your book, and this is a chart. Now, I would have turned the thing upside down, to be truthful, because the shareholders, I think, are at the bottom. You know, they form the base of the mutual fund. But the shareholders are represented by a board of directors that oversees the fund's activity. And the board of directors is supposed to be watching out for the shareholders' interests. It turned out that many of the boards of directors were just, what we say, rubber stamping the decisions made by the investment advisors. So now there's been some tweaks to the rules to give the board of directors more teeth. But, you know, in reality, folks, to get on the board of directors, you got to be kind of famous, and you got to be able to schmooze and be politically astute. So if you don't trust a mutual fund company, don't think the board of directors is going to save you. I would do my own research and not trust the board of directors. And then they oversee the mutual fund itself. But the mutual fund is not just one entity, folks. The mutual fund has several entities that make up the organization. By far, the most important is the investment advisor, or certainly the one that gets the most press, the most publicity. And these are the people who actually make the investment decisions. These are the money managers. They manage the fund's portfolio according to the objectives described in the fund's prospectus. But notice, they don't hold the money. They don't deal with the money. Look down here in the lower left, custodian. They're the ones that hold the fund's assets, maintaining them separately to protect the shareholders' interest. Do you understand? You're not just giving your money to the money manager. You're giving your money to the custodian. The custodian then goes ahead and buys and sells the stocks or bonds according to the instructions of the investment manager. You understand? Yeah, you're starting to see what's going on here. And over here in the right-hand side, we see the distributor. The distributor. That's sometimes called the wholesaler. This is the company that sells the shares directly to the public or through brokerage firms, other firms. And that's why they're often called wholesalers, because they then talk to the stockbrokers and other investment advisors. The transfer agent is the company that processes the orders to buy and redeem fund shares. So they're the ones who are actually dealing with the actual purchase and redeem orders from individual investors. And then overseeing the entire operation of the financials are the independent public accountants, the big accounting firms such as PricewaterhouseCooper or Ernst & Young or KPMG, and their job is to certify the financials. So they look at all the data and they see, oh, you're supposed to have 1,000 shares of a McDonald's. Okay, where are they? And they go to the custodian and they say, here they are, they're on deposit here at this firm. Okay, cool. Checks and balances. And the next slide or two are just trying to show you what we just went over in written form. The mutual fund is a corporation run by a board of directors. Board of directors are voted in by the shareholders, and they're supposed to oversee the shareholders' interests. The investment manager, or sometimes called the investment advisor, the management company, the money managers, are the people who actually make the buy and sell decisions. There is usually what is called a portfolio manager, but it's sometimes a committee or sometimes a team, sometimes called portfolio counselors. And then there are research analysts, which focus on a specific industry. You have research analysts in automotive and research analysts in chemicals and research analysts in energy. But they don't usually, some places they do, but mostly they don't make decisions. Their job is to become a portfolio manager often. That's what they're trying to do. And then the distributors distributes the shares to the public or to dealers. We'll discuss very briefly in Chapter 5 the initial public offerings that are done by investment bankers. That's what the distributors basically do, is make sure that the shares are openly accessible to the public. The custodian is the company that actually holds the securities, often a bank or a trust company. This is why it's actually pretty easy to start a mutual fund, because there are companies that will play the role of the distributor, of the custodian. And so you basically have to come up with some serious cash to get it started and be an investment manager. And there are other companies that will basically do all this for you. The transferred agent, you might have heard of State Street Research, State Street Bank and Trust. The transfer agent keeps track of the purchase and redemption requests from shareholders, and then the independent public accounting firm certifies the fund's financial reports. Why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Well, mutual funds are highly regulated in order to protect shareholders' investments from fraud and collapse. How often have you heard of a scandal at a mutual fund company? Until 2003, never. Wait a minute, Piano, slide 18. Did you just say mutual fund scandals? You want me to invest in an industry that is plagued with scandal? Well, as a matter of fact, I do, yes. Since 1940, the mutual fund industry has been regulated and escaped any hint of impropriety. You like that word, impropriety? Look it up. It's a good word to know. It means hanky-panky, travasuras, yeah, trucos, wrongdoing. In 2003, some practices that were not quite illegal, but obviously unethical, were uncovered. Only a handful of funds and people were affected. Folks, it was very few people. No, but it tarnished the entire industry. You might have heard, or maybe you heard, never heard of Strong Funds. Janus, Bank of America? Yeah, they had their own funds. Putnam. Poor George Putnam was rolling over in his grave. And Alliance Funds. It was only two people at Alliance that was engaged in these shenanigans. and it tarnished Alliance's entire company's reputation. Two people! The vast majority of companies never engaged in any of these shenanigans. And they really weren't stealing very much from people. I mean, stealing is a bad word. And this might make sense here. It might not. Instead of losing $99,999 on a $100,000 account, the people who invested in Enron or WorldCom or Global Crossing or Adelphia or investors lost a buck, more like a few cents, on a $100,000 account. Well, so what were they doing? They were taking pennies from everybody. And that doesn't sound like much, but when you have a million investors, that adds up. And the example is the guy who started Strong. He was worth, I mean, he started it from scratch. And he was the head, the CEO, and the big Mahatma at Strong Funds. And he was worth, at the time, I think, $600 million. And his take from these shenanigans was about $80,000. Now, folks, $80,000 to you and me is a lot of money, but to somebody who's worth $600 million, and why would somebody do this? It just boggles the imagination, but this always amazes me when people who are millionaires wind up stealing even more money. It just doesn't make any sense. But I think it has to do with the same qualities that got you to where you are get you to do these things. You just feel invincible. You feel omnipotent, that nobody can get in your way. And that's exactly what he said afterwards. He said, I destroyed my life. I've let down everybody around me, all my colleagues and my family and friends. For what? For nothing. For basically nothing. And he's barred from the industry for the rest of his life. And so it's very, very sad. It's very, very sad. So don't worry. Unless you are in a very unusual relationship, your mutual fund will not play in these games. Obviously, these shenanigans, what they were doing. Well, you're probably thinking, what were they doing, Payan? Okay, I got a couple more minutes. For example, mutual funds are supposed to open-end, be bought and sold once a day. 4 o'clock. New York time, 1 o'clock our time, that's the price. Some companies or individuals were being able to buy mutual funds after 4 o'clock. Now why is this important? Well, it lets you know what the... yeah, right, you got to understand, right? You can wait until afterwards. Or the one that was very popular was this one. Say the market tanks in the United States. It drops a whole bunch. The pricing for the mutual funds is 4 o'clock Eastern time, New York time. But remember that the trading in Japan happened, many hours beforehand. So Japan might have gone up. But in a couple of hours after 4 o'clock, Japan's marketplace and Asia is going to open. And it's probably going to open down. So you know, or you feel, you're pretty certain that Japan and Asia is gonna fall because the United States has tanked. So you can sell your Japanese fund at 4 o'clock New York time, wait for the market to fall next day, and then buy it back the next day and, pocket a 1 or 2% or whatever. That's not what mutual funds are for, folks. You're not supposed to buy and sell mutual funds as if they were stocks. That's what ETFs are for. That's what people use ETFs for. So now companies will not let you do this. It wasn't quite illegal. I mean, you're buying and selling, but mutual funds are long-term investments. And some companies, such as Vanguard and Fidelity and American, just simply didn't let you do it. I mean, if you did it at American funds, they would let you do it. Well, now they don't even let you do it. They make you wait 30 days. But if you did this buying and selling, they would just shut you down. They would just say, sorry, you can't do that anymore. All requests must be in writing, and you can only redeem shares. We're not going to let you purchase shares. Vanguard would just simply not honor the request. They would say, sorry, we're not going to do it. other companies like Oppenheimer and Fidelity and Franklin, they'll let you do it, but they'll charge you 2%. They'll say, oh, we've seen you've made a purchase in the last 30 days like this, a purchase and sale like this, so we're going to charge you 30 days, a redemption fee for doing this. So go right ahead. You want to do it? You go right ahead. Yeah. Any gain you make is going to be swamped. Any, you know, half a percent, a percent gain you can make is going to be swamped by the 2% fee that is paid to all other shareholders. You understand? That goes back into the pot. So, these kind of shenanigans. Don't worry. 20 years from now, there'll probably be some other. I don't see how the industry can really come up with any other, but that doesn't mean I'm not that smart, you know. 20 years from now, there'll be some other hint of impropriety. Okay, I've talked long enough. When we come back, folks, we're going to discuss mutual fund fees, something very important for you to understand. See you next time.